I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Texas has the highest maternal mortality rates in the country, on par with countries like Uzbekistan. What can Texas learn from other states that have successfully reduced their maternal mortality rates? KUT's Ashley Lopez reports.
Donna Kreuzer has been trying to stop mothers from dying for years now. It's personal. Her daughter, Christy, had a history of depression. So when she got pregnant about 8 years ago, postpartum depression was something that Kreuzer was looking out for.
We openly talked about it, and I thought that everything was all up and up, and we all had somewhat of a plan.
Postpartum depression is one of the most common complications following a pregnancy. It affects about 1 in 6 new mothers in Texas. But Kreuzer says Christy kept her symptoms a secret.
She did not want to turn our focus of total jubilation and joy after finally having our first grandbaby. She didn't want us to focus on her problem, so she kept it a secret for 8 weeks.
Christy was on a business trip in San Antonio when she finally said something. Kreuzer had come along to help babysit.
She came through the hotel door, and a mama always knows. The look on her child's face was telling me something's deathly wrong here. And she came, and she came forthright telling both her husband and I that she had been suffering with postpartum depression since day 3 of our grandbaby's life.
Kreuzer says her family and friends immediately stepped in to help. She saw a mental health counselor, doctors. She had people supporting her. But even with all that help, Christy took her own life. She was 36.
I'm sort of the belief now, although I don't know that I will ever know the true reason, but I have to think that the delay in intervention was playing a major part in her inability to recover.
Kreuzer has been keeping pressure on state lawmakers to improve screening and access to mental health care for mothers who need it. So far, the state has been slow at coming up with ways to curb maternal deaths. When I talked to Kreuzer last summer, she says she was happy about a Medicaid screening law that was going into effect.
It's a baby step. We're moving in the right direction. We're moving forward, but we still need to do more.
As lawmakers look at more ways to address the state's maternal mortality crisis, experts have pointed to California, which cut its rate of maternal deaths by half in just a few years. I learned some important lessons when I went to see what they did. The first, acknowledge there's a problem and find smart people to fix it. This is something that Texas has at least started to do.
I'm Dr. Lisa Ollier. I'm a professor at Baylor College of Medicine and the chair of the Texas Maternal Mortality and Morbidity Task Force.
The task force she mentioned was put together by the state legislature when public health officials started noticing a serious problem. The task force meets quarterly to review data about maternal deaths and figure out what happened. For now, the group is mostly researchers and medical professionals. So far, they have found pregnant women in Texas are dying from cardiac issues, drug overdoses, hypertension, hemorrhage, sepsis, homicide, and suicide. Which brings me to the second lesson I learned in California: get good data. But Ollier found it's hard to get good maternal death data in Texas. In fact, a new report released early this year found Texas has some very serious data issues, which includes overcounting some maternal death statistics.
I was not surprised to see this report.
Ollier says she's seen evidence of both undercounting and overcounting in some cases. However, she says things could improve. Lawmakers recently passed a few bills addressing some of those issues. Which leads to lesson 3. Use that data to figure out what to fix. We have at least a snapshot of what's killing mothers in Texas. Ollier says she's working on a program that would put together what are called safety bundles in hospitals around the state. They're similar to California's toolkits, but not exactly the same.
Speaking as a retired healthcare executive, I would feel a lot more comfortable that my moms are getting safe care when they show up if I had in place the California toolkits.
Ted Fox is a retired hospital CEO. He says the safety bundles are a good start, but California's toolkits are just better. He says they cover everything.
From what supplies to have on hand, what equipment to have available, how to recognize the symptoms, what the roles are of the different folks, how they need to respond, and in what order.
Fox says they're incredibly useful and readily available to anyone right now.
That's something we could do, but we're not doing it. And I guess I don't understand that.
But there are some hospitals in Texas that decided on their own to use California's toolkits.
Hey, Carrie, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good.
This is Melissa Benson. She's the director of nursing for women's services over at the Children's Hospital of San Antonio. This labor and delivery ward is pretty new. Benson is keeping an eye on a few patients giving birth here.
So this is a sound we hear quite often in this department. Baby doing very well.
This new delivery ward's OBGYN in chief is Dr. Peter Nielsen. He's building a department from the ground up, literally. There are parts of the ward still under construction. And already, Nielsen has started incorporating the California toolkits into the ward's procedures.
Much of their work, much of the CMQCC's work, we've adopted here.
Nielsen says when he heard about the toolkits and how well they are doing in California, he thought a hospital in Texas would be a good place to use them. And he says at first, getting hospitals to give this kind of thing a shot isn't easy.
Healthcare is a system. And unless you engage the system and you engage the culture of the people in the system, it's really hard to change behaviors.
Nielsen says so far he's seen good results with the toolkits. Keeping track and collecting data is an important part of how to improve things too, he says.
The ability to make changes is directly affected by your ability to measure what it is you want to change. And so you have to measure it constantly. You have to report back to yourselves as a group. And you have to hold everyone accountable together.
Accountability. That's the final lesson I learned in California. And by the way, this is where Texas has the most work to do. I talked to Stephanie Teleki about this. She's with the California Healthcare Foundation. Her group gave California's Maternal Mortality Collaborative a bunch of money to build a public database that holds hospitals accountable for things like C-section rates. And here's something that jumped out at me about how it got built.
This was not a government-led initiative.
In other words, you don't have to wait for politicians to make this happen.
This was really smart people at who understand data and understand the need for it to be low burden, low cost, coming together to create this data center that lives completely outside of government.
Everyone I talk to says improving things in Texas will require hospitals, the government, and community leaders to work together. If one is left out, Teleki says, maternal deaths are going to be hard to prevent.
This is not a solvable problem by one entity. You know, it's all of these different things together. And I think that's what has been unique in California is sort of the degree to which we've been able to kind of come together around this topic.
Dr. Lisa Ollier, the leader of the state's Maternal Mortality Task Force, says she's at least starting to see different groups come together and acknowledge something needs to be done. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Next week, Ashley investigates why Black women are four times more likely to die while pregnant after childbirth. Coming up next on Fronteras, Hollywood composer and Texas native Germaine Franco talks about Coco and how she created some of the sounds that went into the Oscar-winning movie.
So I got my little botas that my mom bought me from a zapatería in Juarez, and I recorded them on a piece of wood.
That's next, after this break. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. A South Texas college was awarded a $100,000 grant in January to encourage underrepresented students to study STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Congressman Henry Cuellar, whose district extends from the Rio Grande in South Texas to San Antonio, presented that National Science Foundation grant to Laredo Community College. Speaking to us by phone from Laredo, Cuellar says the NSF is expanding its emphasis on STEM by hosting a conference in March.
This money
is to bring 83 different universities and colleges to Laredo Community College and Texas A&M International to answer those questions. This is a question that will help the universities and colleges, but it would also help the National Science Foundation, which, as you know, they do a great job on research, to help them answer some of the questions that was posed to us.
Some of those questions included how to focus STEM education on universities with a strong minority presence. Cuellar says the NSF is concentrating on encouraging STEM studies in Hispanic-serving institutions. Those are the universities and colleges participating in a federal program that serves first-generation, mostly low-income Hispanic students. 83 Hispanic-serving institutions will descend on Laredo in March for the NSF STEM Conference. Cuellar says it will bring professionals, students, and teachers together to learn how to expand STEM opportunities to an underrepresented population.
The earlier they start getting fascinated by science or by engineering, whatever the impact is, and if we can make the connection that, you know, one of these days will be, you know, they'll be discovering the new technology, the new iPhone, the new whatever the product might be. That's what we want them to do. The face of the state of Texas is changing. No ifs and no buts. It's changing. So as we're changing, we got to make sure that those minorities that sometime in the near future are going to be the majority, those are the people that will be running our businesses, will be in public office, will be our professors, will be our teachers, and we got to make sure they start off, especially in areas where we need minorities, Hispanics, and women also in the STEM education.
The NSF conference in Laredo is March 23rd through the 25th at Laredo Community College and Texas A&M International University. The Disney Pixar animated film Coco walked away with two Academy Awards last weekend, Best Animated Feature and Original Song, Remember Me. One of the members of the songwriting team is native El Pasoan, Jermaine Franco. She's a composer, orchestrator, and percussionist, and she's the first Latina composer invited to join the music branch of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Franco wrote several songs for Coco with the film's co-director, Adrian Molina, and she arranged, orchestrated, and co-produced the Oscar-winning song. I had a chance to speak with Franco at an annual gala held by the San Antonio Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, where Franco was the recipient of the Impresario for Equity Award. She says the path from a young percussionist in an El Paso youth orchestra to becoming a Hollywood composer was a long one.
I started out as an orchestral musician, playing in different orchestras in Europe, in the Texas Chamber Orchestra, the Houston Pops Orchestra. I was a sub. I performed all over Houston with orchestras and my own Latin jazz group. And it was through working as a musician and leading my own group that I started writing charts out for my band. And I started enjoying, oh, let me try this and, you know, play it for the guys and lots of different musicians. And I started realizing the joy of hearing ideas from your head, putting them on paper, and then having musicians realize them. So I traveled through Mexico. I was taking all these lessons, playing with a lot of different musicians, and I got a job in a theater. I was a music director for the Los Angeles Theater Center, and I started to get asked to write for small films. So it went from performing to theater to film. And then I wound up getting a chance to work with a master composer named John Powell. And I worked alongside him, and he was doing these huge Hollywood blockbusters. So I worked alongside him. He gave me the opportunity of a lifetime. And I started orchestrating, doing additional music, doing some songwriting for him, and production, you know, editing, recording. I used to produce sessions for him because he'd be busy writing for the orchestra, and I would produce the soloist on Kung Fu Panda and Kung Fu Panda 2 and 3. So, and then I got to meet other composers, and I started getting, you know, independent films on my own, and eventually I was getting enough projects on my own that I was able to leave his studio, and one of those projects was Coco.
So it looks like a lot of the work that you did was for animated films. But when it comes to animation, is there something sort of special that goes on between the composer and the animator where obviously you're working with what they've already written, but do they also work with you? Like you might have this really great idea for a piece of music and you would like the animation to follow.
Well, that is an example that happened on Coco. It doesn't happen a lot. I mean, usually there's a composer and a songwriter. Sometimes they do both. I was one of the songwriters on Coco, and they had an idea for the song Un Poco Loco. I got the lyrics from Adrian Molina, Lee Unkrich, the director, and Darla K. Anderson, the producer, and we had a phone call, and they said, okay, this is the idea. They're at a talent show, so here's a song we want it to be, you know, Musica Jarocha, which I love, and Adrian happens to love, so we were right on, you know, we love that style. So they basically gave me the task of writing and just gave me some script pages, and they gave me some ideas, and I started writing to his lyrics, and then I realized, oh, there's got to be zapateado, because, I mean, if you're jarocho, you know, there's always that in a song. So I got my little botas that my mom bought me from a zapateria in Juarez, and I recorded them on a piece of wood, and I recorded it on my own, and then I took it to them, and I said, here's the middle section. It needs to have this dancing. And then they really liked it, and then they animated to it. And then when we went to Mexico and recorded over 50 Mexican musicians, we got Mono Blanco, which is one of the top jarocho groups in Mexico, and we got the, you know, maestro to do the zapateada. So when you see the characters dancing, they are really dancing to, you know, authentic zapateado. And that was one instance where, yes, the music kind of influenced the animation.
So you did go to Mexico to get a lot of these influences in this music. Was it really essential for you to actually go to the source to really make this a really authentic film?
Well, I think that was always one of the desires of the filmmakers and Pixar and Disney, to make it as authentic as possible. And that's why they created a team of consultants, you know, different Latino leaders. And they made many, many trips down to Mexico. They went to Oaxaca, Michoacán, all over, studying, talking to people, taking pictures, and just really immersing themselves in the Mexican culture. And so that was, you know, one of the main goals. You know, the filmmakers from, you know, working with them, I always saw them taking such care for details, and they asked for me to do that in the music as well. I worked with also Camilo Lara, who's a Mexican musician, who connected us with all of the fantastic different groups. We had banda, we had jarocho, we had, you know, ranchera, we had the most amazing marimba group called the Nandayapa family that has this tradition of over 300 years in their family. I mean, we went to the roots of some really amazing musicians. And then Michael Giacchino wrote the score, and he, you know, asked me and Jeff Krika to help orchestrate. And so it was just this a great experience. And then I was able to work with Robert Lopez and Christian Anderson Lopez to help them orchestrate and co-produce their song, which is now nominated for an Oscar.
So do you think, because this film opened, it opened so huge, was it kind of a surprise to you that it was so embraced by all cultures, by all countries, something that is so uniquely Mexican, the Day of the Dead? Was it any surprise to you that it was going to be such a hit?
Well, just me personally, we were all hoping that people would love it because we loved it so much. I mean, I guess I'm not really that surprised, because everybody loves music. Every culture has a musical tradition. Every culture loves food. Every culture celebrates, you know, their family in a certain way. It's amazing how, especially in China, it's become a huge hit there as well. I mean, it's the biggest, you know, box office film in Mexico itself. I mean, I guess I wasn't surprised because of the care that I saw that went into it through working with directors and the producers. But, you know, one never knows. It's, you know, people's tastes are finicky, so it's a big boon and blessing that people are enjoying the film.
Was this sort of the film that really opened doors for you? Because you've obviously worked with some major film composers. You've worked on some huge movies. But as far as getting unique critical acclaim, is this something that really has opened the door wide open for you.
Yes, I have to thank Disney and Pixar, and especially there's a person named Tom McDougall who really believed in me and gave me this opportunity, because I've been working behind the scenes on over 40 blockbuster films, and I was always, you know, in the background, just keeping my, you know, head down and doing the work. And this was an opportunity for me to be on the music team, really, and just to be supported that way as a Latina, as a woman of color, as a, you know, a Mexican American, is a huge honor. And so I took that job very seriously, and I just worked and I gave my heart into, you know, as much as I could. I did the best that I felt that I could do, because I wanted to honor my family and my ancestors.
Remember me, though I have to say goodbye. Remember me.
Germaine Franco is part of the Oscar-winning songwriting team for the Disney Pixar animated film Coco. Her credits include more than 30 tentpole productions, including Toy Story 3, How to Train Your Dragon Parts 1 and 2, the 3 Kung Fu Panda films, and Fargo, among others. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.